Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Blood and treasure, the economics of conflict from the Vikings to Ukraine, has been described as a brilliant book by the Financial Times chief economics editor. Chock full of marvellous nuggets. It's both important and surprisingly cheering, believe it or not, because you may or may not be aware that wars are expensive, both in human terms and monetary ones, but at times they've been an important driver of economic change and progress. I'm delighted to say that Duncan Welding joins me live on the line now. Duncan, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure's all mine. What was, if you like, the spark that made you want to write Blood and Treasure?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I'm an economist by background. I've worked in economic journalism, in economics. I've written a book on British economic history. So I've always been, you know, involved in and interested in economic history. And I've also always been really interested in military history. And I thought there was a space there for bringing together economics and warfare, the history of both. Because, you know, the central argument of the book is that the two have always fed off each other. Economic change and economic developments have affected wars and how wars are fought. And the development of warfare and how that's changed the state has had really big economic implications too.
Because if you look at it, I mean, we're coming up, obviously, we've celebrated the 80th anniversary of victory in Europe. We're coming up to the 80th anniversary of victory in Japan as well. But if you look at the huge technological developments that happen, the huge amounts of manpowers that are involved, and the mobilization of nation states, looking at how, for example, you know, FDR, I know Roosevelt was saying, you know, the New Deal, etc., to a car in every garage. But if you think about how the United States was, for example, the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, huge migration within the states itself, and then suddenly it becomes a huge economic powerhouse. And after the war, of course, you have, you know, those Camelot halcyon days of the 50s.
100%. I mean, you know, the American economy, you know, hit really hard by the Depression beginning in 1929. Yes, you have the New Deal in the 1930s. You have all of these big infrastructure projects. You have, you know, President FDR trying to put people to work through sort of public spending programs. But the big recovery in the American economy, as you say, happens in the Second World War. You know, suddenly you've got all of these huge orders, you know, as America becomes the arsenal of democracy, as it becomes a major producer of planes, of tanks, of all of this equipment of war, and the American economy booms. You know, generally, you're right. You know, we've just had Victory in Europe Day. We're heading towards Victory in Japan Day, or the end of the Second World War. The Second World War is really hard to understand without grasping the economics behind it. You know, for the Western allies in particular, Britain, America, you know, this was a war, you know, fought using economic means. They had a huge amount of industrial production, and in the end, they could outbuild their opponents.
But also with that, if you look at what happens after the war as well, it reshapes, you know, the quote-unquote peace that we've enjoyed since then, because not only do you have, because warfare, horrendous though it is, absolutely spurs technological development. I was only saying this yesterday. So 1939, you know, for example, Blitzkrieg, the Nazis go in, the German army go in, and a lot of it's horse-drawn. And yet by the end of the war, thankfully they haven't got, you know, nuclear weapons, but they do have jet fire, you know, they have jets, they have V2, the rocket program, and that's in the space of 6 years, because countries, and look at the you know, the mass production that's going on in the States as well, with you know, bombers coming out literally every day. You know, the bombs, the bomber that delivers the atomic bomb, you know, pressurized cabins. Within literally a couple of years, they have made strides economically, technology, that you wouldn't have been able to do, quite frankly, in peacetime, Duncan.
100%. And, you know, it's the same in the First World War as well. You know, in 1914, Europe's great powers go to war. And, you know, I mean, the French still are wearing blue uniforms at times. You know, these are primarily infantry armies that don't look very different from the armies you'd have seen in the late 19th century. All of the armies of 1914 still include a large cavalry component, mm-hmm, of mounted soldiers, often still carrying swords or lances in the German army. And yet by 1918, you've got planes in the sky, you've got tanks fighting on the front, and the number of machine guns and automatic weapons in these armies has changed beyond recognition. You know, a typical British battalion of about 500-600 men went to war in 1914 with two machine guns. By 1918, it's more like 40 or 50. You know, this huge innovation under the pressure of war in technology you see in both of the total wars of the 20th century.
We've been talking 20th century, but one of the great things about this book is that you go much, much further back than this. And one of my current favourites, because I can go down rabbit holes quicker than Alice, trust me on this one, but one of my current ones is a reappraisal of what we call the original Hun, the Mongol Empire, Genghis Khan, yeah, etc. And the Pax Mongolia and the vastness of the empire, and in a world, Duncan, where we're looking at saying, oh well, globalization is a bad thing, we should be fighting, certain sectors are saying that, it hadn't occurred to me, but here's the argument, and please make it: Genghis Khan, father of globalization.
100%. You know, to understand Genghis Khan, I mean, you need to step back for a moment and think about the steppe, you know, the great Eurasian steppe, which stretches all the way from Hungary to China. This sort of, you know, huge expanse of grassland throughout central Eurasia. And, you know, the economics of the steppe are very different to the economics you find in China or the Middle East or Europe. It's a harder environment. The climate is harder. It's much harder to, you know, grow stuff there. It's much harder to have the settled agriculture you get in China, the Middle East, and Europe. So the population, rather than being mainly sedentary and farming and living in villages and towns, is primarily nomadic. You know, these are herders who move around with their horses, with their animals. It's a very different type of society created by that climate. Genghis Khan is able to unite the Mongolian tribes, the Mongols, and build this spectacular empire, which stretches all the way from China into Russia, as far south as into the Middle East. You know, still one of the largest empires the world has ever seen. But yes, the economics of this then become interesting, because once you've got this political union covering central Eurasia, then suddenly travel along the Silk Roads from Europe to China becomes much safer for the first time in centuries. And you do get the first flowerings of what we might call globalization. Ideas, people, and goods were on the move all along those Silk Roads. Now, you know, the technology of the early mid medieval period isn't modern technology. You can't move really heavy stuff very far. So the kind of goods that are moving are things with a really high ratio of value to weight. So it's spices, it's silks, it's that sort of thing. But we do have long-range global trade for really the first time in a very long time. So the first modern flowering of what we now call globalization.
Because that's the really interesting thing, because if you look at Marco Polo, who everybody raves about, you know, his discovery coming back from the, and again, we are now in the 21st century, so this is entirely the wrong language, saying that, he discovers, brings things back from the Orient. It's only the Orient if you're looking at it from a European perspective. But if you look at the writings of Marco Polo, etc., he's traveling a route that others are using. So it's not one, you know, one man or one intrepid band going discovering. This is a back and forth trade route, which is introducing all sorts of, you know, all sorts of things between sort of China and Europe. I mean, for goodness sake, Charlemagne gets sent an elephant at one point along the Silk Road, if I remember correctly.
No, I was going to say, yeah, you're right. I mean, Marco Polo's not the only one. He's the most sort of famous European. But, you know, during the Mongol Empire, there are sort of, you know, commercial guidebooks published by Italian merchants sort of talking about the enormous returns you can make by trading down these roads. And yes, lots of sort of great inventions, you know, which have been, you know, circulating in China for a while, make their way to Europe along the Silk Road. So, you know, gunpowder is probably the most famous, but also lots of Chinese medical techniques. All of this, you know, what's fascinating when you read Marco Polo's accounts and the accounts of other primarily Italian merchants who made this voyage is they're really quite impressed by Mongol rule. You know, they note, for example, that the Mongols have a system in place whereby if crops fail in one area that they're ruling, then they have a system whereby the, you know, the agricultural surplus from others will be moved to that area, prevent famines, almost like an insurance system.
Mm.
This is something which didn't exist in the Europe of this time.
Because the Europe is built on a feudal system that demands you stay where you are and serve your lord and work your land, etc. However, the Pax Mongolia, or the Pax, you know, Genghis Khan thing, it's basically something I heard it described the other day. It's kind of run like the Sopranos, you know, because they're a mobile empire. So you rock up and you know, the Mongols knock on your front door of, you know, your city state or whatever and say, okay, you know, do you have the Tribune this, you know, this year? And if you do, everything's good. And if you don't, well, look what happened to the one down the road. And they look across the ramparts and see something sort of smouldering. But they do have this system where they, you know, they can move stuff quite quickly because they're a mobile type of empire.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's not, you know, this is the thing about the Mongol Empire. You know, it's a steppe empire. It's not like, you know, the British Empire or the Roman Empire or the French Empire. It's not that they turn up, you know, plant a flag and put in place sort of colonial administrators and all of that. It's bands, large bands of Mongol warriors who turn up and demand tribute. And exactly, the Sopranos is the example to go through. This is like a mafia extortion racket. It's people that turn up every few months, and you have to pay them. Now, in return for paying them, you do get the protection. You do get, in economic terms, some public goods. You know, one reason that the Silk Roads suddenly become available for travel is they provide, you know, public order. They provide some leasing along these roads. Because the Mongols control the whole territory, you can be reasonably certain you can make that journey by ship from Europe to Crimea and then overland to China. You're going to be moving through the territory of one sort of political union, which provides some protection for merchants. And also, the Mongols were very keen on merchants, very keen on trade. They saw the advantages of this. And, you know, they had a rule that the first time they dealt with merchants from a new place, they would offer them an especially good deal to encourage them to come again.
Fascinating. You also look, because we could get out of a Mongol rabbit hole, as I said before, you also look at, like, things, for example, the Vikings. Now, Viking economic, I mean, we kind of think of that as, you know, arrive, slash burn, get the gold out of the monastery or the nearest religious building, because that's where it is. And is it a sort of scorched earth party, or are we talking Danelaw, where they just pop over to the UK when they need a bit more for the coffers? What's your take on the Viking age in terms of economics and warfare?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things we can say about the Vikings. And the first one is, you get this change. So your initial Viking raids in Britain, in France, all the way down into the Iberian Peninsula, around into the Mediterranean, it's a very, in economics term, zero-sum game. It's some people turn up in a boat, they attack often a monastery, they kill anyone that tries to stop them, they carry off any movable wealth in a boat. Now, the economics of that aren't particularly interesting. But what is interesting is you start to see a shift in Viking behavior as the Viking Age moves on. In economic terms, there was a wonderful economics writer called Manco Olson writing in the 1960s and 70s. And he had the theory of the stationary and the roving bandit. Now, you know, you or me, the ideal type of bandit to be robbed by is neither. No one wants to be robbed by a bandit.
Yeah, fair enough.
But if you are, yeah, fair enough. And if you have to be robbed by a bandit, you would rather it was a stationary one than a roving one, because their incentives are very different. You know, a roving bandit is encouraged to grab as much as they can carry, and it doesn't matter what sort of damage they do when they're stealing stuff. The stationary bandit, who set themselves up in an area, well, they're suddenly incentivized to ensure that you, the person they're regularly robbing, are still there to be robbed in the future. And this is what we start to see with the Vikings when things change. You know, in Britain, in the 860s, we see what people call the Great Heathen Army.
Yeah.
This is, you know, a Viking invasion on a scale unlike previous raids, an army of several thousand, which is here to stay. You know, conquers Northumbria, East Anglia, into Mercia. We see similar things in what's now France, you know, the sort of seizure of the Duchy of Normandy, and, you know, around similar things happening in Sicily. Now, these Vikings, who are staying in plus, they start to look more like the Mongols. They start to look more like an extortion racket. They, you know, demand regular payments, but in return, they do provide some protection.
It's an interesting, yeah, because presumably if you're just going on a slash and burn economy in terms of your warfare, you're going to burn, pardon the pun, you're going to burn yourself out because there aren't enough places to actually keep that going unless you're in a state of total warfare. And it's interesting you mentioned Normandy because obviously the Vikings sort of morph into the Normans and then we, you know, 1066 and all that.
Oh, but this is the fascinating thing about 1066. You know, there are three claimants to the English throne. We've got, you know, William, Duke of Normandy, descended from Vikings who have taken over Normandy. We've got Harald Hardrada, the actual Viking king of Norway.
Yep.
And we've got Harald Godwinson, who is part of, by this point, an Anglo-Danish nobility with a lot of Viking. I mean, they're all different flavors of Vikings in one way or another. Vikings turn out to be incredibly effective state builders throughout Europe. And here's the interesting thing, though. If we look at the Viking Age, if we look at sort of the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, you know, you've got this sort of huge amount of Viking raids during this period. You know, historians tend to call it the Viking Age. And yet, in as best as we can tell from the evidence we have, primarily archaeological, you actually see an increase in trade and an increase in economic production around the North Sea world. So the Vikings, rather than, you know, collapsing regional economies, their presence seems to be stimulating them. Because, now, one way to think about that is the Danegeld. You know, people talk about the Danegeld, you know, this idea of, you know, payments to get rid of the Vikings. You know, they turn up, they demand X amount of silver, you hand it over, and they promise to go away for a bit. Now, the Danegeld and paying the Danegeld has a bad reputation. Kipling wrote a poem saying, never pay the Danegeld because they'll just come back. I always think sort of the advice, never give in to bullies, is much easier to hand out several centuries later when you're not being menaced by a lot of Vikings.
Yeah.
But the evidence we have is that, you know, you've got to think through what happened. When a Saxon or a Frankish king made a tribute payment to the Vikings, what did the Vikings do with that money? Well, quite often they spent it, and often they spent it on the goods and services of the people that had been, you know, handing it over. So actually, you make these tribute payments, they spend some of the tribute on your goods and services, and what you see is an increase in production and trade.
And not only that, of course, we're just looking at, we're being North Sea centric, if you like, because the Viking goes all the way down, you know, the Danube to Constantinople. Hardrada ends up in there. He becomes part of the Praetorian Guard. Yeah. And again, it's that trade route, because all these Viking cities or ports that are along the great rivers heading to the east, it's absolutely fascinating. It just turns what we think, what you're taught as a schoolboy, you know, which is basically Kirk Douglas in a pointy hat, on its head.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, they're fascinating. I mean, this is the thing. You know, there's a huge debate amongst historians. You know, should we think of Vikings as, you know, raiders and pirates, or should we think of them as explorers and traders? And the answer is both at different times. You know, they were very, very far. You know, fundamentally, they travelled all around the Mediterranean world, all around the North Sea, you know, as far as Greenland, into the Atlantic, up there into what's now Ukraine and Russia as well. Sometimes they were trading, sometimes they were exploring, sometimes they were raiding. It depended on the you know, the circumstances they found each time.
Just looking at some of the others, because otherwise we're going to go completely sort of before the Renaissance. But you also look at such things such as more recent conflicts, Vietnam. Now, obviously, my take on Vietnam is it's you know, where the Cold War is kind of fought out. It's the domino theory. America is extremely paranoid after the Cuban Missile Crisis of it coming to South America. So they absolutely sort of pile in on, unfortunately, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. There's an economic point to this as well. Is this quote unquote the you know, Nixon and the, you know, the military industrial complex, quote unquote? Quote.
Yeah, it's some of this. It's also, I mean, what I find fascinating about Vietnam is if you look at sort of the key US policymakers driving the decision
making, etc.
McNamara and all of that. You know, I mean, the one I focus on is Walt Rostow. He was originally in the White House under Kennedy. He was pushed out to be part of the National Security Planning staff. then brought back by Lyndon Johnson as national security advisor. Now, Walt Rostow was an economist, and more than that, Walt Rostow was at the time a world-famous economist. His book, The Stages of Economic Growth, A Non-Communist Manifesto, was one of the best-selling economics books of the late 50s, early 60s. He was sort of, you know, a well-known sort of public intellectual economist. And he was really, really central to driving American policy on Vietnam in the early to mid-60s. The thing about Walt Rostow is, though, he thought he was acting in a very, very rational way. He had a theory of what was happening. Now, to Walt Rostow, this communist insurgency in the South was nothing to do with conditions in South Vietnam. It was all ultimately driven by Hanoi and North Vietnam. He was utterly convinced of this. And his argument was, we can get them to stop the insurgency by bombing North Vietnam. Walt Rostow had worked as a targeting officer for the United States Strategic Air Force in the Second World War. He was convinced of the power of bombing to change, you know, to have real material impacts. So what you see throughout the 60s is, you know, bombing of North Vietnam on a scale which is really quite staggering. You know, more ordnance dropped on North Vietnam in the 60s than dropped on Germany and Japan together in the Second World War, in a much smaller country. And Rostow convinced himself this was going to work. What he didn't get was he had completely misread not only the incentives of the North Vietnamese leadership, but also what he wasn't really grasping was every time the US stepped up bombing of North Vietnam, the end result was more Soviet and Chinese aid for North Vietnam. So you're in this bizarre position that you get so much bombing of North Vietnam, more ordnance than in the Second World War, dropped on this small, undeveloped country. Its economy was bigger in 1975 than 1965, because every time the bombing stepped up, more Soviet aid or Chinese aid would flow in to make up the damage.
And conversely, of course, when the Americans pull out of South Vietnam, it absolutely cripples their economy, because they have been literally being, you know, suckled by the American military machine, and it's gone. So all those bars, all those services, you know, all those restaurants have gone. And so South Korea not only has South Vietnam not only has lost American military support, but suddenly the economy just not it was particularly strong anyway, but just falls off a cliff. And that is when everything goes horrendously wrong for them.
And then, you know, the war is over.
Yeah.
You know, relatively, quickly at that point. But, you know, I think what's interesting is, you know, one lesson of the book is that economics is one message of the book, I should say, is that economics is a useful tool for understanding conflict. The problem is, that's not to say that economists make the best decisions. You look at Vietnam, look at Walt Rostow as a key decision maker there. The man got almost everything wrong. And what's worse is he was convinced he had an internal model in his head which explained North Vietnamese behavior, which gave him a path to ending the war. But his path to further escalation just never really worked.
That's a really... I could talk to you about that one and the mindset that all links back. Second World War, New Deal, bright new world, we're doing the new world order. But I can't let you go because I've only got 2 minutes, so bear with me. Because one thing leapt out at me on this, which is about how pirate captains were pioneers of effective HR techniques. Now, are we saying that Bluebeard, Blackbeard or Jack Sparrow, quote unquote, are now the masters of how to hire and fire?
Well, look, the thing about pirates is...
Yes.
Think about a pirate ship, right? A pirate ship is, by definition, crewed entirely by career criminals.
Yes.
It's got no recourse to courts or anything like that. And it's not only, you know, a ship crewed entirely by career criminals. You know, it's out there taking loot. And yet, the evidence suggests mutinies were less common on pirate ships than they were on naval ships or merchant ships, despite it literally being crewed by criminals. How? Because pirates had what they called pirate codes. They had this clear set of rules, which everyone signed up to, which said how booty would be distributed, which said how decisions would be made, which laid out punishments for not following the rules, which governed standards of behavior. And what you essentially had was this really good good style of management, which bound the incentives of everyone on the ship together and led to really smooth operations.
Brilliant. The book is called Blood and Treasure. It is by Duncan Wells, and you can get it from our own virtual bookstore, which I advise you to do. Duncan, 10 seconds, where can people find you online?
They can find me on, primarily these days, on Blue Sky, where I am Duncan Weldon, DUNCANWELDON. Or they can find me on X, formerly Twitter, where I am a bit less frequently nowadays.
Thank you very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you.